God has appointed me to be a traveling man for Him, and I've been away from home, I suppose, 50 to 60% of every year since we've been married, except for our time at West Memorial. And sometimes when those overseas trips came that required us to be apart for 3 months, the whispered words with the goodbye kiss at the airport have been from this 29th verse, "The time is short." Listen to the words of Paul. "But this I say, brethren, the time has been shortened, so that now on both those who have wives should be as though they had none, and those who weep as though they did not weep, and those who rejoice as though they did not rejoice, and those who buy as though they did not possess, and those who use the world as though they did not make full use of it. For the form of this world is passing away." If those words spoke of an urgency in the heart of Paul in the year 38 or 50 or whatever the year was A.D., I just wonder what would be in the heart of Paul if he could live in this present generation of the earth. The time is short. That had meaning for Paul because, one, he knew that men without Christ were dying apart from the gospel. Two, that he as a human being had only so many appointed years to share the gospel before his chance to do it was over. And three, he believed in the imminent return of Jesus Christ. But in our world today, there is an added dimension beyond those three dimensions that ought to cause you to sleep poorly on your bed tonight. Now, I'm going to make a statement that is hard to understand, and I want you to think about what I'm saying. I want it to soak in because it's too difficult to comprehend unless you're concentrating very, very hard. Now, I want you to imagine what 4 billion people might be like. That's approximately the population of the earth today. The fact of the matter is we passed that particular population figure a good many months ago. But just imagine 4 billion people that are on the earth today. Now take all 4 billion of those people and go with me to the year 2000 A.D. and consider that in 2000 A.D., the 4 billion who now live on the face of the earth all will live in urban centers. Now, can you get your hands on that? In 22 years, the now existing population of the earth is approximately the same identical number of people that will live in urban centers in 2000 A.D. Now, to fully comprehend that fact, we must first consider the world's population explosion. The human race is growing so fast that it will double in about 25 years. It required the entire history of man to give birth to the first billion people in 1830. From Adam until 1830, all of those thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years, and finally in 1830 we hit the first billion people in the earth. It took 100 years to add the second billion. The third billion came in 30 years. In 14 more years, we added the fourth billion, and by 2000 A.D., in the next 22 years, we will add 3 billion more people to the earth. Demographers are conservatively forecasting 7.2 billion people by the end of this century. And the world is now bracing itself for the task of housing and clothing and feeding those billions, most of whom will be too young to work. Unfortunately, the largest birth rates are taking place in the nations that can least afford the cost of new people. Zambia, for example, has a growth rate of 3% in 1970. And that's an astonishing growth rate, because it means that Zambia will double its population in only 24 years. And the per capita gross national product in Zambia is $220 a year. That same year, 1970, 600,000 people perished in one cyclone that swept through Pakistan. It took only 60 days for that nation to replace the dead with 600,000 babies. I came to you last night as Ralph Neighbor, the pastor. I come to you tonight as Ralph Neighbor, missionary. And I speak to you of a world, young college student, that is going to be your world in your generation. And I speak to you, middle-aged pastor, ready to settle back and consider retirement in the next 10 to 15 or 20 years of your life. And I say to you, the time is short. And we are so sleepy and lethargic in the Church of Jesus Christ today that it is enough to make statues weep in sorrow. Now I want you to consider the explosion of the young that we are experiencing right now on the face of the earth. In Southeast Asia, there are many nations where 63% of the entire population are under 21 years of age. In Singapore, 65 out of every 100 people are under 21. I lived in a society like that. It's mind-boggling until you spend over 3 years living with it. In Africa, Rhodesia and Kenya have the highest rates of population increase in the African continent. And the continuation of birth rates like those countries are experiencing means that they're going to double the population in 21 years. And that means children, 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 children exploding into the world. One of the forgotten facts for the Christian strategist is the youthfulness of our earth. Consider the amount of budget your church spends on its youth ministry. Consider the amount of personnel, the amount of activity, or even discussion we have shared in regarding this crucial matter in the past years. And the church of today, what does it do? It gets a college student. Come on, work with our young people. I talked to a youth worker over in Atlanta the first part of this week at a conference there for the Atlanta Baptist Association. He said, you know, I'm getting to be 30 years old now, and I really think it's time for me to go on and do something beyond just working with kids. I didn't know whether to kick him or cry. Now, it is true that one in his 20s finds it effective to work with those in the teens, because you can't work with somebody who is 40, and the older you get, because of your experience, the broader your ministry can become. I understand all that. But it is a passing shame that we continually relegate the winning of youth to the young neophytes who are coming up in the organization until they get enough experience working with the youth to go on and be a holy man. What we need to recognize is the fact that we are moving right now into an earth where if we do not catch the youth before they leave their teens, their value system is shaped, and we need to have a strategy to win the young people. It's virtually 10 times harder to win a person at 26 than 16. And when we realize that the present group under 21 in the earth today is monstrous in size, we face the fact that the time is short. We cannot dawdle 4 or 5 years getting ready to proceed, to start, to commence, to begin, to reach them, because by the time we get all cranked up with our big denominational machinery and get it all running, they're going to be too old then to be reachable. The problem is a critical problem, and it is a world problem. Critical, too, is the need for the rapid discipling of the existing youth in our churches. They're our greatest asset for evangelizing young people, and too often we feel the married and the middle-aged are the only ones who can undertake the great tasks for God. I go to denominational meetings and come away sick. Monday night and Tuesday night, I spoke in Atlanta to an evangelism conference of the Atlanta Baptist Association. There was not a single person in the room under 30 years of age either night. I go to the Southern Baptist Convention, and they're all a bunch of old, half-dead people like me there. What is happening? When people come to West Memorial, over and over again, we hear the comment, "I've never seen anything like this. This is the most unbelievable church I ever saw." Half or more of the audience are young people. Yeah. They better be. We're just trying to match what's happening in the world today. The young are the pilots who fight. The young are the soldiers who go to the jungles. The young have always been the risk takers of the world. And we need to recognize that if we're going to have an effective evangelism in the world today, it will be the young who do it, and do it in a fraction of the time that older people think that it's going to take to do it. We've got to train young men and women with the spiritual and practical tools to cut new patterns to reach their generation for Christ. And that's why I believe discipleship ought to start with teenagers and not with adults. And that's why I want to underscore what Ronnie said. It is idiotic to think that a youth program is potato chips and Cokes and happy fun and games. We need to take these young people when they're in junior high school and get them into discipleship ministries. And we've got those in our congregation right now, three on our staff, two fellas and one girl, and they are commissioned to do virtually nothing else except disciple young people using discipleship materials. Because it's the only way we're going to get the job done. In developing an urban strategy, much attention has to be given to the ways youth congregate. I don't know whether this is true or not today, but just a handful of years ago, I was with Roy Edgman in Tokyo. And one evening, he took me to an area of Tokyo called the Shinjuku District. And there I watched 20,000 young men and women milling around in the streets and shops long past the hour of midnight. Not one evangelistic thrust had ever been attempted in that area of pleasure. Hundreds were simply there with nothing to do. They were available. And yet nobody in any of the nearby church buildings that were locked up tighter than a drum at that hour when 20,000 people were in the streets had ever opened its doors when the streets were crowded. They opened for worship on Sunday morning at 11 o'clock when the streets were bone dry. New patterns are needed. And to keep pace with this expanding population of the earth, the Christian community, write this down in your notes. I want you to have this. To keep pace with the expanding population of the earth, in the next 22 years, the Christian community is going to have to add 62,500,000 converts a year from now on to the end of the century. The alternative to an evangelism that will reap that fast a harvest is frightening. At the present snail pace of evangelism that we're keeping, some missiologists are forecasting a world Christian community of less than 1%, 1/10 of 1% of the total population of the earth by the end of the century. Now, we may well rejoice that at the present time, the spiritual birth rate in Africa is 5 times greater than the physical birth rate. But I spent most of January working with 9 nations in East Africa trying to help them develop an urban strategy. And the thing that I hammered home at those missionaries until they wept in their prayer was the fact that Africa is right now the last major continent of the earth to begin to urbanize. And they're going to have to face a fact that is important to you who live and work in California today, and that is the population implosion that is coming along with the explosion. The urbanizing of the earth is a new phenomenon in the history of man. In 1800, only 5% of the people in the earth lived in cities. Presently, 51% of the earth's population live in cities, and by 2000 A.D., 73 out of every 100 people on the face of the earth will live in a community of 100,000 people or more. Is that soaking in? Is that really getting through? Africa is going to grow from 400 million
to 813 million by then. Nairobi will be four times greater in size in 22 years than it is today. Mombasa will grow from 331,000 to 1,296,000. Kampala is multiplying fivefold. Cities in Asia swamp these statistics with their sizes. Manila, Jakarta, Bangkok, major cities all over the Philippines, doubling, tripling, quadrupling in size. Tokyo, 25 million people. The world urbanization is going to require the equivalent of 5,000 new cities of 500,000 residents each to be built in the next 22 years. We're going to go from 172 cities of 1 million people currently to 300 cities of 1 million or more by 2000 AD, and 200 of those 300 are going to be in the third world. Now, if you have never been out of the United States of America, that statistic won't bother you unless I expand on it. Come with me to Mexico City. It's just a couple of hours plane ride from Houston. Come on, let's go to Mexico City. A city that today has a group of poverty pocket residents numbering in excess of 4 million people out of the 10 million that live in Mexico City. 4 million people living in tar paper shacks. 4 million people living in cardboard boxes. 4 million people living under little bits of plastic raincoats. 4 million people who breathe their own defecation as it dries in the sun and is turned into dust and becomes that which infiltrates the nostrils. Come with me to Jakarta and look at the people who live on the sides of black canals in which human excrement floats on the top of cold black water, and watch them as they hold their hands against the current so the excrement floats around and drink the water and have a life length of about 38 years. Come with me to India and see those who are born and live and die on street sidewalks. Come with me to Bangkok and walk with Bill Smith and myself as we put on some old shoes and go into a swamp area in Bangkok that is about 5 miles deep and 13 miles wide. Swamp water that'll get as deep as your knees in almost any area of that monstrous section of square mileage of swamp, and look at the mountainous sea of humanity that have taken bamboo poles and driven them into the swamp water, and have taken castaway stolen boards and have made sidewalks 12 inches wide out of them. Sway with us as we walk down into that area of homes. Homes, pieces of wood, pieces of cardboard, pieces of plastic, with all of the human excrement of over 200,000 people floating on it, with leprosy and every kind of imaginable disease in it, with women who have illiterately been sent by their parents in the rice planting areas of Thailand because there's no money from the crop failure this year, so one more girl is sent to Bangkok in prostitution. Come with me to Nairobi, where I was last month, and walk with me through that area called Mathari Valley, where 100,000 people live on the side of a little river. Meet 30,000 prostitutes. They don't do it because they think sex is fun. They do it because a woman who can't read or write has nothing else to keep her survival intact. When you go to a third world country, you go to a major city where approximately one-third of all of the people don't have enough money in their pocket to know where meal number six is going to come from. They've got enough ahead to pay for today's three meals and the two meals tomorrow, and beyond that is always oblivion. That's the way they live. getting old cigarette butts and taking the fresh cigarette out, making one cigarette and trying to sell it, getting glass and pottery that has been cast away out of garbage cans and smashing it up and selling it to the cement makers, getting the rags, getting the newspapers, getting anything they can get from anywhere, selling their bodies, doing anything they can do to survive, to exist. The cities of the earth, there are 200 of them going to exist by the turn of the century in the third world. And there is not one single effective witness for Jesus Christ in the slum areas of any major city in the world that I have ever visited or learned about. Not one. They go to hell because they're poor. You'll find our Baptist missionaries working, but not there. The day Bill Smith and I went into that slum, Bill said, "Ralph, as far as I can tell, this is the second time in the history of the world that a Southern Baptist missionary has set foot in this area. I went a month ago, and you coming back with me means that you're the second man who's ever set foot in this area." And whether it's Tondo in Manila, or whether it is that swamp water of Bangkok, or whether it is the Masai Valley of Kenya's Nairobi, wherever you go, whether it is Mexico City where the Paracadistas have come, wherever you go, the problem is an unsolved problem. There is no missionary work being done. And I find precious few that even want to attack it. Yet when you consider the urbanization of the earth, and when you consider the percentage of those in the urban centers who live like that, and when you consider the unresolved need and problem there is, it is literally screaming for somebody to get in there and to begin to develop an answer to it. And I'll tell you, the answer is not going to come from existing missionaries. It's going to come from some of you young people in this room right now who will say, as you marry each other and establish your wedding bed, "We will deliberately withhold the bearing of children for 5 years or 8 years or 10 years so that we can go young enough and strong enough to be able to function in a society like that. We'll live on the edge of it where we ourselves will not die of disease. We cannot raise children in an area like that. And we will do what we can to find an answer that is quickly repeatable in many places by many people." It's got to be done. But I don't know of a missionary organization, including the Southern Baptist Foreign Mission Board, that is making a concerted, hardcore, honest attempt to get this problem solved in the shortest period of time. There's not one missionary organization on the face of the earth that has really locked horns with a problem. And until we get deadly serious about the new world we're living in, we will be the responsible people for this generation going to hell. We take our old antiquated methods that make our churches, our Baptist churches in California, remain neutral without growing, and we think because it doesn't work in California, it's going to work any better in Singapore or Bangkok or in Nairobi. Nonsense! Build a church building. Beautiful, isn't it? Look at those stained glass windows. Look at that fancy organ. Look at that big cathedral. I was in a church in Atlanta. The pastor drove me out of his way. Instead of taking me to my motel after I had preached, he drove me 4 miles out of his way. I didn't know where I was going. I thought I was going to the motel. I was irritated to the point of exasperation when I found out that 11 o'clock at night, this preacher was taking me to see his auditorium. And he and his wife said, "Oh, this is the most beautiful auditorium." And they took me into this thing with a great big vaulted ceiling and these big expensive candelabras and these big plush seats. And at 11 o'clock at night, I had to see it. And I said to him, "Pastor, I have just learned something about you, and it's breaking my heart." And I stood in the middle of his fancy auditorium at 11 o'clock at night and told him about the slums. And I said, "Do you know it makes me come to the stomach turning point to come back to America and find that this is what a preacher thinks is important to show off at 11 o'clock at night. We have come to an absurd point. We've come to a point where we need to recognize that even though we can make a lot of money, if we're smart, and if we are the people of God we claim we are, we will say, all right, this is the amount of money it takes me to live. And I can live frugally on this amount of money without causing any sacrifice to my wife or my children. I shall live on that limited amount of money, and if God gives me 30 times that amount of money, I take this amount and the rest of it goes for His ministry. Because unless we do it, we will never fund the project. But what we need right now is not money, we need the project. We need people who are willing to say, I'll pay whatever price is necessary. And we don't even have the machinery to crank it up and get it going yet. It's sitting there like a time bomb with a fuse lit, getting ready to blow in our faces. And we haven't even commenced to proceed to start to begin. Oh, my friend, I just tell you, the problem is that it is usually the educated who plan to stay in the city because their training makes it impractical for them to return to the rural area. And out of all of those that are migrating into the major cities, a tiny fragment are those who are educated and they come and receive their university training and then settle back to make the wealth. And for every educated person that comes, come these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds from the rural area who come not because they want to live in the city for the movies and the bright lights, but because it is starvationville back in the rural area. There's nothing left there. And the rural people who can survive in the rural area stay because they've got money coming in and roots planted. But the rootless people of the rural areas flock to the cities. And when they get there, they jam up and the governments are embarrassed to face the reality of their existence. In Jakarta, if you ask the government of Indonesia what the population of Jakarta is, they'll say it's 4.2 million. You ask any taxi driver on the street if that's true and he'll laugh. He'll say, no, it's closer to 8.5 million. But they don't want to admit the others are there. If they admit these people are here, they have to give them a place to go to the bathroom, and they have to give them decent water to drink, and they have to do something about the housing condition, so they're not there. They're not on the official records. They're not on the official books. And this is a truth that goes around the world. My friend, equipping saints for ministry means what? I tell you, I wrote down what Brother Billy Hanks said this afternoon. Do you want to be like Jesus? And his Paul hissed in his face, one robe, one pair of sandals, and spit on your face. What does discipleship really mean? If we want to be equipped for ministry, I'll tell you where the ministry is. The ministry is in a world that can't afford the gospel of Jesus Christ. A world that goes into oblivion at age 38 without ever having heard it because they don't live on the right side of town. After a full week of teaching and pleading with pastors in Jakarta, during which time I walked through those cardboard shacks that housed over 2 million souls in Jakarta, one of those pastors took me to his church to preach on Sunday morning, and as I looked out over that audience, I whispered to him and I said, how many of these people can read and write? He said, all of them. I said, the slums aren't here, are they, Pastor? The slums that you and I have walked through. And after a moment, he turned to me and he said, God didn't equip me to work with such people. I'm unable to understand them. I must continue to work with the educated. He was telling the truth. Unfortunately, we've priced the gospel too high for the urban poor. They're almost literally condemned by their poverty for eternity. We can't consider the city's evangelism pattern without considering the poor. Rural patterns of evangelism don't fit slums. Rural patterns of evangelism don't fit cities. Buildings we build that people won't come into are worthless buildings, no matter how high the ceilings are inside them. We've got to find the answer to the problem and find it quickly. And you know, an amazing thing has been brought out by Ed Dayton, that those areas of the world, and California is one of them, as you know, that is the terminal end point for those who are migrating in from the outside. People who are migrating in, people who are leaving one city and coming to another city, one area and coming to another area. People are trying to get it all together in a new section. People who move in are migrants, and they are one of the most successful groups of people open to evangelism. Migrants took the gospel to the Roman Empire. Paul went to migrants called Jews when he went evangelizing in cities. The seed of the Word of God was not scattered everywhere in equal measure by Paul. It was sown specifically among the migrants, the diaspora. Such groups are often more responsive in the city than in the village. Being away from home creates conditions that are favorable to evangelism. The traditional guardians of customs and ideas don't exist in the city. People away from home are off balance, impressed by what they think they would have considered unthinkable or strange back home. Think of those converted in the book of Acts who were migrants at the time of their conversion. The eunuch of Ethiopia, Barnabas from Cyprus, Saul from Tarsus, Cornelius the Italian, Lydia from Thyatira, Apollos from Alexandria. And again in the trips I made to California, I've had preachers say, these people have come in from the Midwest and from the South and come to California, come to get away from God. That is absolute nonsense. I won't buy it. We have not found the key to unlock their hearts. But I know from my studies of sociology that in the first 3 months a person settles in a new area, in the first 3 months, I say, in the first 3 months, he is more open to change than he has ever been before in his life or than he will ever be again as long as he lives in that place. They're critical months. As people move in and their whole lifestyle is up for grabs, what can happen? Listen, in Japan today, only 1% of all of the people of Japan have ever been evangelized by the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of missionaries that are sent there by the scores and scores of mission boards that are trying to get Japan evangelized. 1% of the Japanese in Japan are Christian. 700,000 Japanese migrated to Brazil after World War II. 43% of the Japanese in Brazil have become followers of Jesus Christ. Why? They're migrants. That's a story repeated by the Chinese. Less than 1% of those on the mainland were Christian after 10,000 missionaries had worked among them. But you go to the 40 million Chinese refugees that are living around the world today, and 7% of them are committed Christians. Much attention has to be given to the fact that when people migrate in, the church should be ready to make contact with them and be the people of love to reach their needs. And I don't care whether it's Los Angeles or Jakarta, the same thing is true. And if we would be aware of this fact and if we would intensify our efforts to make contact with those that are moving into our communities and go to them not with a, hey, come to the Baptist church, but with a contact that says, what can we do to let you know we love you? Here's a frozen dish that our women have made up. You can just pop it in the oven and let it warm up while they're unloading your furniture. Here are a list of the doctors and the dentists in town. And here are the things that we can do. And what are your needs? And how can we minister to you? And how can we help you? People who are in motion are in crisis and are easily reached. But in order to work in these major cities of this earth, whether they're here or overseas, we have got to recognize that rural minds don't work effectively in cities. Do you know, William Matheny pointed this out at a foreign missions conference I attended. some years ago, big cities remain a mystery to Southern Baptists generally. Baptists, as a rural people, come to the city, and by history and temperament, they continue to think in rural terms. The city ghetto is as foreign to Southern Baptists as a foreign country. We're not at home in the city. Our sermons and our Sunday school literature are full of rural illustrations and small town stories. Matheny's words delivered at the 1970 conference for furloughing missionaries reminds me of what one foreign mission board member told me as I got on a plane to go to my short-term assignment in Singapore. He said over 90% of Southern Baptist missionaries now serving grew up in rural or village contexts and never lived in a community of more than 50,000 people, possibly before they went to college or seminary, and they have no concept of how to work in cities. We are a rural-oriented people, and even in the cities, we tend to move to the suburban areas and maintain rural-oriented values and attitudes there. Now, that's not good or bad in itself, but it does reflect who and what we are. And when we take the rural concept of the church and try to do it in the major sprawling urban areas, we bomb out every time. And when we're so closed in our minds that we won't look around and see what is working in the urban area and say, hang the theology behind it, hang the guys that are doing it, how can we learn from them? By our closed-mindedness, we destine hundreds of people to an eternal hell who could be one if we would just change our attitude. The time is short. And I just pray with all my heart that just two or three or four who are in this audience tonight will begin to get a vision and have the courage to step out and say, I'm going to find a way that works and I'm going to commit myself to it, no matter who likes it. Many existing needs in the world today are not being met because, as one young student at Baylor University said to me a few years ago when I spoke there, he said, my church that I belong to was dragged kicking and screaming into the 20th century. As we consider the millions that are in the world today, may I return as I close my message to the potential task force that can reach them with the gospel. The Holy Spirit has sealed every believer and has endowed every believer with spiritual capacities for ministry. Every single member of the church must find a ministry in evangelizing the city. More and more of God's finest pastors are resigning the role of the holy man to become the coaches. This is the highest task God can call a man to do. It may not make him the biggest amount of money. He may not be elected as president of the Southern Baptist Convention. But I want to tell you something. Those who shepherd their flock with the Spirit of John, saying, those members of mine must increase and I must decrease, are going to see the most rapid growth in their churches. The entire earth needs the power of a relief laity who are equipped through discipleship to begin to meet needs that cannot be met by a small little group of professionals. They are the only ones that can penetrate neighborhoods through visiting and witnessing. That is where we've got to go. Caring for people spiritually so that they grow to become ministers. You know, God has a plan, and that plan is functioning in the world today. But we're going to fail miserably in reaching these masses that are exploding into the earth unless we draw a line and say, behind that line, I thought one way, but across that line, I refuse to think the way I've been thinking. Men's plans are always marked by a peculiar pattern, friend. They can be achieved by the sweat of a man's brow.
And many a preacher has come to the end of a month of hard work and has looked back at those who have joined the church and the fine organization that is oiled and moving well with the machinery of all of the church staff. And when the plan is accomplished, if that pastor can only fully explain it by the work he and the people have put into it, nothing more, nothing less, he ought to say, those are God's. Those are not God's plans. Those are my plans. God's plans aren't like that. Joshua, let the men walk around Jericho for 7 days. And then after they walked around for 7 days, blow some horns. What, Lord? Just have them walk around it and blow some horns, Joshua. What about all the military training I got? What about all these swords and spears? Never mind, Joshua. Just walk around and blow some horns. Well, God's plans are always impossible for men to achieve in their own strength. And they always point to His power alone when they're complete. And it's to God's task I call us to, friend. And I remind us that God's plans are not always our plans. Sometimes God's plans cause us to abandon comfortable ruts. Sometimes they have a do or die calling to them. And sometimes we go to God's place for our lives and then fail to find God's plan for our lives when we get there, simply because we're afraid to fail, and some of us are even afraid to succeed because of the cost in terms of time that will be demanded from us if we are successful. When Joshua stood in Gilgal before the battle of Jericho, the angel of Jehovah appeared. And in the last verses of the fifth chapter of that book, Joshua turns to the angel of Jehovah and he asks him, he says, whose side are you on? Are you on the enemy's side or are you on our side? And the angel of Jehovah responded and he said, let me get something straight with you, fella. I'm not either on the side of Israel or on the side of Jericho. I am on God's side. The question is, Joshua, are you on God's side? And that's where we need to come in asking our questions of ourselves tonight. God's up to something in this world. Are we up to what God's up to? Or are we ready to ask Him to breathe on our plans? I tell you, there's an act of abandonment when you follow Him. And when it doesn't matter what anybody thinks, as long as you know you're in the middle of His will, I ask this question of you. Are you on God's side? This little group of Christians that is assembled here tonight have been brought into this room to hold in our hands the destiny of literally thousands of humans, many yet unborn, who could be touched by our lives. And we're not going to have their spiritual destiny in our hearts if we have our own private destinies in first place in our hearts. We can't find God's pattern for our world if there's hardness and ambition in our hearts. We got to learn to weep over the cities of this world as Jesus wept over Jerusalem. We got to be ready to pay any price to the death of the self-life we ambitiously live in order that they might be reached. We must not cling to our security blankets of jobs and careers and routines. We must be ready to surrender our self-directed lives to a higher purpose than that. We've got to recognize what Jesus meant for each of us, as well as for Peter when he said, Peter, when you were a young man, you were an ambitious fella. And you girded yourself and you went where you pleased. But Peter, when you're old, when you're matured, when you're discipled, men will carry you where you won't choose to go. And death will be no problem to you.
Such self-surrender to the will of God is a hard thing to come to, friend. And many men and women spend their lives serving God without ever getting there. But we can't afford the luxury. The time is short. I propose that we close this conference tonight, in this session of the conference, by doing some wrestling with the angel of God. I'd like for us to start crying out, "Oh God, I won't let you go until you bless us. Our plans are not sufficient. Our minds are not adequate. We're sick of our labor, which produces only what man can produce by the sweat of his own brow. Oh, Holy Spirit of God, fall on us. Anoint us. Show us our sin and cause us to confess it. Give us a love for one another, so that our love for the lost will not be crushed between the resentment and jealousy we have between each other. Lord, if we walk with a limp forever after, we shall gladly pay the price. Only don't let us go on through these crisis days without your anointing for our task." I want you to bow your head with me. In this moment, I'd just like to ask you, if you would just in your heart, with your eyes closed so that you can't see anything around us, would you just take a look at whatever part of that world I've been talking about tonight God leaves burned in your memory? Is it a section of this greater LA area? Or is it a section of one of these third world cities? What is it? Where is it? And I'd like to ask you to examine the plans and the value system that you now hold in your life. And you answer the question for yourself, is your value system adequate to meet the challenge of what's happening in the next 22 years in this world? And is it time for you to do some re-evaluating and get some priorities straight? Is it time for you to say, "Oh God, I have played around with what I have known in the back of my heart always you would call me to do. Young lady, you put a young man before God's plan. You want to live that way? You want to bury your children knowing that that's what you did? Young man, you want to put your pride, your ambition, your fear before whatever God might have fully laid out for you? You want to live the rest of your life remembering that tonight you had the chance and you turned it away to climb the holy man ladder or whatever else it is you think is important in your life? It's a time to evaluate. It's a time to face it squarely. You don't save your life until you lose it. You don't gain your life until you've given it. And I don't know, because I'm not God, what He has for you. But listen to me, pastor of the church here tonight. You can go back to your comfortable rut if you want to. Or you can begin to agonize with the fact that in the last 5 years, your baptism rate has not kept up with the population growth in your immediate church field, and agonize before God and say, "Oh God, I don't care who thinks what. I've got to be where you want me to be, and I've got to lead my people in something that is effective." It's a time for evaluation. This is a conference on equipping saints for ministry. Are you really serious? Or are we listening to a bunch of sermons and technique and getting some new notebooks and some new pages of notes? Where are we going with this? Oh, Father, I ask that in these moments you would do a work in our lives that is deeper than just getting out of our seats and coming forward. I ask that you would do a work that is deeper than just some instant response to something that we haven't really thought through. Oh Lord, I pray that you'd
give us some sleeplessness on our beds tonight. I pray that you take us into a period that might go on for hours or days in which we really take a look at our values and decide whether we will allow social pressures and acceptance of others and personal careers and ambitions and desires for another individual to love us or marry us or, oh God, whatever it is. I just pray that you'll bring us to that point of abandonment in which we fling our lives recklessly into your hands to say, Lord, whatever the cost is, make me ready to pay it and send me to the need. Now I give you a gift of love, my Christian friend. I give you a few moments when I'm not going to say a word and you're not going to say a word, and we're going to hush and we're going to listen as God speaks. Ronnie, you sing for us as we get alone with the Lord. Reputations at full bloom and able to coast and do it easily. But Lord, you said that in the last days the old men would have a vision. And you told us that in the last days the young men would have a vision. would dream dreams. Oh God, how last can the days get? How short can the time be? Please, Father, hear our heart's cry. Give the young men dreams, and give the old men a vision. Before it's too late. In Jesus' name, amen.